Welcome to the Invisible Church Podcast. I'm Pastor Tim Smith of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in New Ulm, Minnesota. In this installment, we're meditating on Genesis chapter 1, verses 6 to 13, and days 2 and 3 of creation. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hope you all had a good Easter. And I promised you something last week I'm going to do now. I promised you a way I discovered for remembering the seven words from the cross. Okay? So this is a picture, not a list. No, this is all English. In fact, there's a reason why it's all English. I'm going to draw it for you large here on this piece of paper I have. Let's begin with a giant capital E, but I'm going to not draw it just as the line, so I'm going to draw it in a block so I can fill in spaces on it. Can you all see? Okay? So far, so good. How many words were there?
Seven.
So, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, like that. So the E is the beginning, middle, and end, correct? The tines of the E. And Jesus addresses God, his Father, three times. That's what the E is, the beginning, middle, and end. Okay? So the first word is Father, forgive them. The middle one is Eli, Eli, my God, my God. Okay? Just going to write Eli there. And the last one is, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Okay. Can you see okay?
Yeah.
After Monday, what are the days of the week?
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Stop. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's 2, 3, 5, and 6. The intervening pieces. T, W, T, H, and F, right? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And those are the other statements of Jesus from the cross. We begin with today. You'll be with me in paradise. Woman, behold your son. I'm thirsty.
I'm thirsty.
Right? And it is finished. Okay?
Is that the order?
Yeah, that's the correct order. Well, the seven words come from the four Gospels.
Collectively.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't go to any one of them and say, oh, this is the order in which they are.
Well, you can if you're very careful.
I wasn't careful.
You can, if you're very careful, you can figure out that the first thing he says is while they're actually putting the nails in, Father, forgive them. And then you have to judge, is this before or after the darkness falls? And that's your clue to the other words. Is it before the darkness, after the darkness, and then is it right before he dies? And that's how you get the other ones, but that's the seven words. But giant capital E, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
What is the Greek word for finish?
Tetelestai.
And that means paid in full?
Yeah.
And that's what Jason and I had a discussion last night. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Significant about that finish.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a good observation on his part.
Absolutely. Remember, traditore, tradutore. The translator is a traitor. So if you begin to dig into any translation, you will find places where you're not happy with it. Okay? But that's an old Italian saying. Traduttore, traduttore. Translator is a traitor. Bob, you have a finger going up there.
The forward in Christ had an article at the end that Jesus was probably speaking Aramaic, and his word would have been from Shalom, Shemi, or something like that.
Something like that. But the Holy Spirit inspired John to record tetelestai for us because of the precision of the Greek word. That it means that it's in the perfect tense, which means that it occurred in the past, but it continues on forever. So, yeah. But as for what language, apart from Eli, Lama Sabachthani, you know, I don't know what language he was speaking for the rest. Maybe being Jesus, maybe he did each of the seven in a different language. You know, he starts in the original German and then moves on, or whatever it is. But anything else on that? Yes?
Which of these words were, like, before it got dark? You know, how?
Oh, it's the my God, my God. That's the transitional moment, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's at about noon. Okay? All right, we're moving now. If you have the copy of the handout, there are extras. If anybody besides me forgot theirs, I forgot mine. It's on my desk at home with a note that says, don't forget this. It really is. But we're on page 6.
You're at a point where you need a note to read your notes.
I've begun using...
a knotted handkerchief,
string tied around my finger, things like that.
Your wife can remind you too.
Too many things to remind me of, because she always adds, and oh, by the way, and it's too much to remember, so I know my limitations. You have a grid of 6 squares here. We're coming to that today. I think we'll get to it during day 3, but we're not in day 2 yet quite, or almost. But I ended last time saying that our understanding of creation rests in our understanding of the resurrection. Those things are intimately connected. And what I mean is this. There are those who believe that God can create life from death. I believe that. That God can make life from death. Or, if you will, that God can create something from nothing. Those are connected, aren't they? Life from death. All right, there are those who believe that nature can create life from death. And recognize there, that's the crux of evolutionist theory, that there was something that was not animate. Anybody know what it was that was zapped to life to create? I don't mean the Big Bang or the creation of the world, but the way that life itself began with the first living creatures, according to evolutionist theory.
An amino acid.
Amino acid, right. Probably zapped, I think the theory suggests, by lightning or something like that, or just the correct circumstances where they came together in a puddle somewhere so that out of the goo came me and you, right? Okay. There's also a third theory that was espoused especially in the 19th century, or I should say the late 18th century, that man could create life from death. This still remains in the realm of science fiction. Darren?
Frankenstein.
Yeah, you know who wrote Frankenstein? The granddaughter of a scientist who espoused this theory. She was 19 years old when some friends of hers and she were at a party at a castle in the 1780s, I think, or 1790s, and they thought, let's have a contest to see who can write about this. And her soon-to-be husband, her boyfriend, wrote a poem called Prometheus Unbound, and she wrote a novel called Frankenstein. Yeah, that was Mary Shelley. But a teenager at the time wrote this novel about this, what a scientist would call a golem, an inanimate creature patched together from other creatures. And then how using lightning and electricity, which was a new idea in those days, Ben Franklin was still living, that you could zap somebody into life. So those are the three possibilities. And of course, which one do we know historically must have happened? God created something out of nothing. That's right. God formed a being, breathed life into him, but we're way ahead of ourselves here because we're really just starting day two here with our days of creation.
You say that evolution, we evolved from monkeys and things like that.
Things like that, yeah. And I should point out, I'm not going to talk a lot about evolution because there are all kinds of theories that we could talk about. Evolution is only one of them, but we don't have time to talk about all of them. But I will point out that the kind of evolution that, for example, is espoused by many, but not all, of our public schools is called macroevolution. Macroevolution is the idea that whole species evolve over long periods of time. However, and the thing about macroevolution is it's not provable, right? In fact, when we get to our dinosaur day, we're going to have a dinosaur day coming up. You guys saw some of the slides for that. The great irony is that dinosaurs are categorized into two great divisions, the lizard-hipped dinosaurs and the bird-hipped dinosaurs. And which one do you think all evolutionists say evolved into birds? The lizard-hipped or the bird-hipped? It's the lizard-hipped. Isn't that crazy? The official theory is, oh no, birds must have evolved, and they must have evolved from the lizard-hipped. So you have a transposition there of even what the structure of the creature was. But microevolution, where in a single generation changes can happen within, say, a family of animals, that actually is provable and is seen to happen. So don't be deceived by people who say, well, evolution is provable. That's only microevolution. And what I'm talking about there are, small moths that when my brother and sister and I were little, we used to call butter moths. They're little white or yellow moths that are very common everywhere in the spring and summer. Do you know what the ones I'm talking about? They're not really butterflies, they're smaller. And is the difference whether or not you can see their antenna? Is that one of the, between a moth and a butterfly? I forget the actual distinctions, but these are moths technically. And these creatures in cities with large amounts of pollution, actually in a single generation will evolve gray wings to blend in better with the environment. And if they're removed from a pollution center, they will revert to white wings. That's the white-winged ones. It's just a curiosity that you can do. However, the fact that they revert suggests that it's not really an evolutionary stage, right? It's just more of a transition for coloration reasons. Also, is anybody else besides me frustrated with every American bird book over what's happened to the Baltimore Oriole? Or am I the only one who's that picky? Anybody know what I'm talking about? When I was little, the Baltimore Oriole was its own bird. And they were talking about this other bird out east in the area of Maryland and Virginia called the Northern Oriole, which is kind of a dingy version of the Baltimore Oriole. It's a much darker orange, kind of a rusty brown color. And now all the bird books, whether you get Roger Torrey Peterson or Audubon or whatever it is, all the bird books say that the Baltimore Oriole is an occasional aberration of the Northern Oriole. And they don't even give the bright Baltimore Oriole picture anymore. So forgive me for grabbing a pulpit, but it's my pulpit to grab today. And so I'm mad about that. So my brother is an ornithologist, and so I have a passion for birds that I've gotten from my brother. Day two of creation. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. This is the New NIV. You probably learned this in the King James, for those of you who grew up with it, as the firmament, right? The word, by the way, the reason for it is to separate water from water, water below from water above. But the word vault itself in Hebrew is here spelled out for you. It's pronounced rakia. Rakia. Should we all say that? Rakia. Three syllables, rakia. And the rakia is the vault. Now, this you could use if you're speaking Hebrew, even for the dome over a baseball stadium. Okay, or any kind of a covering like that. Maybe if it was, I hear it on the radio every once in a while. Do you know what's not quite a house and not quite a tent? Because it's made of mud. And it's especially common in the Himalayas, but now they use them around here. It's called a yurt. A yurt. Drives me crazy when people talk about it because it belongs in the Himalayas, not in Minnesota. But a yurt has this firm, vaulty roof. Looks to me like an igloo made of clay. That's a yurt. It's a little bit more permanent than a tent and has a little bit better insulation. I suppose that's why they use it in the Himalayas. But that's this vault, this rakia. Now, it can mean an extended solid surface. I suppose a table, if you're below it, could be your rakia. In Genesis here, a firm place, a firmament. That's where that word got coined for the King James Version. That's one of several words that got coined in the King James. Another one is atonement. You know that atonement really is just the English words at one? Yeah, so that's what atonement means. And a firmament really is just this firm thing. They didn't know what else to do with it in the King James. Or a solid expanse. That might have been the old NIV. I'm not sure. I don't remember. And then a dome or a stereoma, a firmness in Greek. And the Greek translation here is the stereoma. But this dome of some kind, a firm thing. Pilots talked about the firmament also, because there were two barriers that pilots couldn't get through in the early days of jet flight. The first one was the various sound barriers. There's one at Mach 1, the sound barrier, where they thought for a while they couldn't break it because everybody who tried to break it died because their airplane would get torn apart. Then they learned to put the wings further back on the plane and sweep them, you know, angle them backwards a little bit, and to make sure that they were more precisely made, and you got a cleaner break into the sound barrier. And now, for a while, we had these passenger planes that broke the sound barrier. They're not around anymore.
Wouldn't there be a sonic boom, though?
Yeah, of course there would be. Yeah. But the, remember what they were called? The Concorde?
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't fly anymore. The Concordes are all recalled out of service. They're not necessary any longer, but they were ones that flew faster than sound. Otherwise, probably most of us here, unless you were in the Air Force or the Navy, you probably have never flown faster than sound.
It's weird that it would actually go, the evolution, you know, would actually get worse.
There's another echo of the sound barrier at about Mach 2.5 or 6, something like that. There's another little barrier to go through. I have no idea, Darren. I really don't know. I have no idea. But I did want to mention, though, that the other firmness, the other dome, is not the sound barrier, but the actual atmosphere, the transition into space. And the problem there is the quality of the craft, because you have to make a vehicle pretty sturdy up there, because the vacuum, draws all of the air and atmosphere out of a vehicle if you don't have a really good seal on it. So it takes some good doing. I have a relative who designs re-entry patterns for NASA. And when a vehicle comes back out of orbit, it doesn't just come straight down. It would heat up too much and fry. Or else everything would have to be made like the old space capsules were in the 60s. But the space shuttle does it. It comes down, and then it kind of goes up again like a roller coaster. So it cools off, and then it comes down a little bit, then it goes up again and it cools off again.
All the crust is the crust.
No, that's the ground below your feet.
The crust is the ground.
But this is the troposphere I'm talking about.
Okay,
this is what this looks like from below, where we have water below and water above. And then this is what I wanted to show you. This is on a world that has no surface land. You have at the core, that's kind of the Tootsie Roll center of the Tootsie Pop. That's the planet's surface that's submerged. Then above it is the kind of the white area on this diagram is the ocean. And then above that is the troposphere. You see that word there. And that's the area in between the surface of the ocean and this sort of area that's the top of where the air gives out. All of our weather happens inside the troposphere. So from ground level up to the top of this area in the atmosphere called the troposphere, that's where all of our weather happens. All the clouds, if you see clouds that seem to be way high up in the air, they're just skirting the very top of that area. They're not above it. They're always below it. But that's where all the weather happens. So whether it's a cloud high up in the sky or a storm or a weather front, some kind of a pattern or a tornado, whatever it is, it's always here. Always here in the bottom layer. Then above that is something called the mesosphere. There are two more layers above the mesosphere, but I didn't bother to put them on. I didn't want to talk about the ozone layer and the ionosphere and so forth. But that's. And by the way, that is a cutaway view of not the Earth. But as I said before, this is actually the planet Neptune. So our core, the planet part of ours, is much bigger than that. Right? Actually, maybe not. That might be the size of the Earth compared to Neptune. It's very small in that diagram, though, isn't it? They just have a lot more atmosphere above it. Okay, and then this is what it would look like from above. So God made the vault and separate. Oh, Darren, I think I cut you off. Were you going to say something else about that?
I forgot.
Okay, if it comes back to you. God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it, and it was so. God called the vault sky, and there was evening and there was morning the second day. So God gathers some of the water and puts it up in the sky, and the rest of the water he leaves down below. That water today is almost entirely gone, that water that was above. But it seems like it was a completely solid bank like this. Where did that probably go to? The flood. Yeah. We have reason to suspect, I can't say this precisely because the Bible doesn't say, it just hints, but it seems like our sky would have looked overcast like it kind of looks today, that there was just a constant overcast. On day four, when we get to the words, the great light and the lesser light, what do you think of when you hear greater light and lesser light? Sun and moon, but they're not called that until after the flood story in Genesis 8, 9, and or 7, 8, 9. So those words don't occur until later, and so they were still calling them greater light and lesser light, you know, evidently, until that time, and maybe because when we look up on an overcast day, can you tell exactly where the sun is? You kind of got an idea, maybe, but some days you really can't tell. It's just always bright. And on an overcast night, can you kind of tell where the moon is? It depends on how thick the clouds are. Sometimes there can be a full moon, and it's so overcast, you can't even tell that there's a full moon. It's so dark. But you can kind of get a glimpse of it when the clouds thin up a little bit. You can get an idea of where it is. And therefore, an important thing about the moon, if you know what time it is you can also tell direction, can't you? Because the moon in our hemisphere is never to the north, right? And like the sun, it rises in the east and sets in the west, and it's generally south of us. So the same with the sun. And so you can navigate if you can't even see any stars or have no compass, and you can't find a tree with moss growing on it, then you can figure out kind of what direction you're going, And if you know what time it is, those are important things. Okay. Anything on the second day? Dan?
Is it also presumed then that as the water, the thick vault around mm-hmm. the earth that was very moist / humid, what doesn't that also then lend to the belief why there are sometimes found palm trees way up in the mountain that are now predators?
Oh, yes. We're coming to that probably in the flood story, where we're going to live for a while in this class. But absolutely, did you all hear that? That Dan was mentioning that you can find tropical vegetation. For example, they do find gourds and fruit that would be given by a palm tree, sometimes in Antarctica, and high up in mountains where there shouldn't be anything like that growing, and they find things like that growing. And very probably because, in fact, almost certainly because it was at one time, everything was tropical all around the world. And it's also possible, there is one thing that I'll come to a little bit in more detail on day four, but it's also, since I've started talking about it, it's also possible that this idea of Pangaea is at least a possibility that it could have happened that day. Anybody know what Pangaea, anybody have no idea what Pangaea means? Anybody know? Pan is Greek for all, and Gaea or Gaia is the Greek word for the earth. So the idea that the Greeks had and that later some scientists got is that all of our continents were crammed together in one spot, in one big supercontinent that they called Pangaea, and that it broke apart. And the reason this is a theory is because it really does look like you could move South America and fit it into Africa, and they would fit. You know, and the fact that the continents are moving, that's part of the geological stuff that's happening below the surface, is they are all moving in different directions, and kind of, and some of them are away from each other and some of them are toward each other, and that's where earthquakes and so forth come into being, and sometimes underwater mountain chains come into being that way. Could God have used, remember when the waters below the surface of the earth erupted in the flood, you know, could that have been the continents breaking apart for a while? And kind of everything submerges also for a while and then comes back up again in the flood story. It all kind of works together, but we have to finally say that's very likely, but I'm not really sure. So, but that's the idea of that. Yes, Bev?
Did it rain before the flood? Was there rain?
I'm coming to that. Seems like maybe not. Yeah, because God will talk about in the story of the plants coming out of a mist that's coming up all the time. And is this mist part of this tropical water system, this hydraulic system that's in place, is that it doesn't really rain. It just sort of is more or less humid given the whatever day it is. And then why would God be able to make human beings that have no concept of clothing for a while? You know, where would you live that you needed that? Well, we still have people in the world who don't have any concept of clothing in some areas, don't we? And they're all around what part of the world? The equator. Yeah. In fact, did you know that there's an island that is in the Indian Ocean that's completely forbidden by all countries? Nobody can go there. It's near the Andaman group of islands in the Indian Ocean, and people have tried to explore there, but there are natives there who are furious every time anything like a helicopter or a boat comes near, and they have a habit of lobbing spears and rocks at helicopters and boats, and they tend to kill people who land on their island. There were a couple of fishermen who were, I think, pearl fishing. Isn't that done in the Indian Ocean somewhere? A lot of pearl fishing. Anyway, two guys got too close and they wrecked their dinghy or whatever it was. And they were, I believe, captured and killed by these natives. And there's footage of the natives sort of dragging them into the forest from and throwing rocks at a helicopter that was trying to rescue them. And so these are folks who are still, we would say, Stone Age people who don't have any concept of like metalworking. That's how you get to the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. Most of the Old Testament is in the Bronze Age. The New Testament is in the Iron Age. But some people in the Old Testament, from probably Abraham to about Moses, are still living in the Stone Age, because they don't really have a concept of working with bronze. They buy it and they know about it, but they don't know how to make it. Do any of you, or are you all Stone Age? What's the recipe for bronze? Anybody know? It's 15 parts copper to about 3 parts tin. But it's not fair because my last name is Smith and I grew up knowing those things. So, okay. I'm going to pause for just a moment. Anybody need to get up and stretch?